This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Brendan Francis Noonan and Rico Gagliano are experts at hosting dinner parties, or at least virtual ones. They are the host of the podcast and radio show Dinner Party Download, and they've guided listeners through 400 audio dinner parties featuring conversations about culture, history, arts, and food. Their radio show ended earlier this month, but they have not stopped their dinner party advocacy. In fact, they believe so strongly in the virtue of the dinner party that they've written a book about it. It's called Brunch is Hell, How to Save the World by Throwing a Dinner Party. Brendan and Rico join me now. Welcome back to The State of Things.
Thanks for having us again.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
A bold declaration here. Brunch is hell. What do you mean?
Well, you know, I mean, we're taking things to extremes, obviously, but in our estimation, brunch represents all that is wrong and evil in the world, and the obvious antidote to it is to throw a dinner party.
You know, each week you're given 2 days off, and to spend one of those days waiting in line for an hour to pay too much money for eggs, then have a couple drinks and leave a couple hours later bleary and drooling, we feel like you're really stabbing the heart. You're stabbing a heart of one of your 2 days off, and that's not a good way to spend your time.
Wait a minute now. We're talking about champagne and orange juice, runny eggs and vaguely colored thick sauces. You don't think that's wonderful?
Which I think that speaks for itself.
We want to drain the Hollandaise swamp. No, those things are great. Just eat them before 11 a.m. at your home.
Yeah,
but that's the difference, because it seems to me what the brunches you're describing are the ones for which we stand in line, pay too much for eggs, and walk away dazed in the middle of the afternoon. However, when you hold them at your home, are they different? Is it any different if you throw it yourself?
It is a little different. It is a little different. I think what we're really saying in this book is people should be having people over to their homes, showing them that kind of civility, and having deeper conversations than are possible when you're sort of out. You know, if you're out, that's first of all, it's a commercial interaction. Second of all, they're trying to flip the table. They're trying to get you out the door as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. You invite someone over to your home. There is no set end time for a dinner party. You can hang out as long as you want. You can maybe be a little wilder. You can maybe try out some ideas that you wouldn't try out maybe in a brief conversation and get into it with your fellow man.
Well, tell us more about this, because that's really the centerpiece of this book, is this business of getting together at your home and engaging in conversation. What is it about the dinner party that makes that the one of the ideal formats?
Well, it's the home itself. You know, when you have someone into your home, it's a reflection of you. We advocate that you should cook at least 51% of the food at your home. unlike a restaurant, it's a real act of intimacy to invite someone into your home. And so just accepting that invitation is a bit of an honor. And I feel like people rise to that. And then once you're in that home and once you've had some food and you create that warm atmosphere, which we discuss in the book, I feel like that's where people can have conversations they can't have at other parts of their life. You know, we live a lot of our lives as employees or employers or as parents or as coaches of little league teams. You know, we have obligations, we have responsibilities, but a dinner party amongst friends, we think that's kind of recess for adults. This is one place you worked hard all week, you did something maybe even that day, and that evening someone invited you over and they're opening up their home, and we think that can kind of create an atmosphere for people to kind of relax and experience a level of play and joy that is rare in the modern world for an adult.
You lay out some essential elements of a dinner party with some minimum standards. Now, what are they?
Mm-hmm. Well, like, to your previous question, actually, one of the things that we say is that a dinner party should have a table. And the reason is not because we're trying to explode furniture sales. It's because we need to have a place where we all gather around. The idea is that it forces us to all get together and share a common conversation. Similarly, you know, food, you need to have food there. But the point of the food isn't to be the most excellent food you've ever had or the most Instagrammable food you ever had. It's to put on the table so that you all share in something together. And I think that's really what all of these rules come down to, although there are a few that are perhaps a little extreme. For instance, we say that dinner party should only be thrown on Wednesdays through Sundays. Through Saturdays, because on a Sunday, obviously, most people are they're thinking about, you know, work on Monday. So that's no fun. Monday, you're doing all the stuff you should have done on Sunday, and Tuesdays are just dumb.
Although that argues for the brunch on Sunday, the fact that you can have it a little bit earlier, but it will get at your home.
Mm-hmm. But,
yeah, you know what I'm saying? Then you got a few extra hours to kind of go home and think about why you got drunk in the middle of the afternoon.
All right. We think that what happens is you spend those 2 hours on the couch patting your belly and binge-watching TV.
Exactly.
Parts of your podcast do make their way into the book, and including some of the great history that happened at dinner parties. You can name a couple, including the placement of our national capital.
Oh, yeah, that's very true.
That's right. I mean, made famous recently with the musical Hamilton, mm-hmm. but the reason our capital's in Washington, D.C. is because Thomas Jefferson threw a dinner party, and he threw it with the express purpose of having two gentlemen meet and try to solve a problem, and it was Madison and Hamilton, and mm-hmm. they were trying to figure out where to put the capital, and over ratatouille and other fine delights, because Jefferson was quite a cook and invented mm-hmm. some recipes himself, mm-hmm. They decided that they were going to put it in Washington, D.C., which they thought was a halfway point between the North and the South.
Yes. And by the way, we're not sure that it was ratatouille. We're guessing that part, but he was a Francophile, so probably was something.
It was probably something that was so ghastly that they decided to put it in a swamp in the middle of nowhere. That's where we're going to put this thing. Mosquito infested.
I didn't say the dinner parties always result in the smartest
good
ideas.
Decisions. Frankenstein. Frankenstein comes to life as the result of an undigested piece of cheese and a dream that followed, right?
That's right. The author Frankenstein was invited over to the home of, I believe it was, I can't remember. Who was
Shelley.
It?
Shelley. And Lord Byron. Lord Byron.
It was Lord Byron and Mary Shelley were dining.
In Switzerland. This little Swiss chalet he had.
They were, and over dinner, they sort of started reading from a book of German ghost stories, I believe. And Mary went to bed that night, had a terrible nightmare, and turn that into the book Frankenstein. So even when dinner parties go awry, they can result in beautiful things.
And that book is still around 200 years later. So there you go.
Yeah.
Now, you say in the book that dinner parties play to the strengths of Los Angeles, where you guys are right now. Is that how about the rest of the country? Is there dinner party? Are there regions where dinner parties are better than others?
Well, I think we maybe in an interview to a Los Angeles outlet we said that, wink, wink.
I'm like, yeah.
We feel like dinner parties can happen everywhere. I mean, L.A., people tend to, compared to New York, people have homes and they have backyards. North Carolina is a prime place to have dinner parties because in a similar way, I feel like people have a little more space and they and actually you have a head start on us. I feel like there is an element of hospitality that one doesn't encounter in my mm-hmm. native New York and in Rico's LA. Mm-hmm. We think these can happen. We can happen anywhere. And that's part of the book, too. I feel like people think dinner parties are these kind of elitist affairs with white tablecloths. But the point of our book is to say, actually, break down that perception and just invite some people over, put some food on the table, turn up a little bit of music and proceed. You know, it doesn't really require a specific location or a specific setting.
And even by the way that we said before, you need a table. Actually, we have a special dispensation for people who have like tiny apartments. For instance, in New York, since the point of the table was get everyone to gather together, if you have a tiny little New York apartment, just being in your apartment is gathering everyone tightly together. So you don't need a
table. That's pretty good. And if you really want an Instagrammable dinner party, you can put it on the back of your cat.
Sure.
That's right.
Well, they give you that.
Interesting. A movable feast.
Let's talk about this because here's the thing. There's some barriers to hosting a party, and there's just so many things the host has to think about that worry them. I mean, and you address some of these, like what we should do with that last piece, last pork chop. Four diners, six diners, one pork chop. What do I do?
But first we go through all the many ways that people tend to divide up that last piece, all of which are deeply not cool. One of them being what we call hippie halves or the theory of infinite division, where you just keep cutting that pork chop into smaller and smaller pieces because no one wants to take the last piece because we're not barbarians. Mm-hmm. So we actually ultimately arrived at a mathematical formula that you can use and you can just plug in some values into it and figure out who deserves that.
Did the guest RSVP in time? Did they bring a bottle of wine? Were they a blowhard at the party itself? And then it's up to the host to kind of reward the final piece.
Now,
it's science.
Do you have the chart on the wall through dinner so that you can then get to the point and prove it? Or do you just have this in your mind?
I think if you're a good host, you've memorized the formula.
Precisely. Or you could break out the book.
Yeah.
Now, if you come from a Mediterranean family like mine, there is never just one piece. There is more food on the table at the end of the meal than there was at the beginning. So this never happens. And really, that's what I was, should absolutely.
That's true.
Now, you say that there's one room that you absolutely must clean. Is this true? Because that would throw me off if I actually have to clean one of the rooms.
We kind of created this list of things to clean because there's been articles written about how people have anxiety about throwing dinner parties. And one of the anxieties is inviting people into their home, and they feel like it's a tremendous amount of work. And it doesn't have to be. We talk about strategies for making it not intimidating. We even have some recipes. But yeah, basically, if you were really pressed and had no time, we say that you need only clean your bathroom, really.
Yes.
That's the only place that people are going to be alone with a bright light shining at some point, and they may judge you. We also recommend while you're in there to peek into your medicine cabinet because your guests might, and you might just want to organize things so that that doesn't become a part of the conversation.
You could go both ways with this. You could try to protect yourself, but you could also just put gag items in there and make them wondering.
That's a great idea.
And
I love
wait
that.
For the rumors to
that
come back
notion.
To you. Yeah.
You can just have a little sign that says, really? Really?
Come on. There's a mirror inside it. It's like a picture of you framed there with really underneath it.
A picture of each of your guests holding an offensive piece of medicine. Now, here's the other problem is which guest and how to blend these personalities, because you hate to get that wrong, and I think people are fearful of having the wrong groups.
Right. Well, here's the thing. We don't think that there's any wrong guest at a dinner party. As long as each guest is balanced out by another type of guest. For instance, you know, a narcissist is a great person to have at a dinner party. They have great stories to tell about themselves. Some of them will be lies. That doesn't matter. It's entertaining. But what you also want is to have somebody who balances that out, which we call the subtle undercutter, who is someone who says almost nothing during the dinner party. But just at the moment when maybe the narcissist is blown a little too hard, they puncture that guy's balloon. They just throw in one little barb, dig the knife in, and just pop him. You know who we're talking about, so just make sure that you have one. Don't have one without the other.
Yeah.
Is there any advantage to having is a potluck better than sort of doing it all yourself, or does it really matter?
Well, I hate to break the news to you. A potluck, unfortunately, is not a dinner party according to our rules and regulations.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing,
yeah.
But we often
First of all, 51% of the food should be cooked by you. So that's one thing.
51% of the food needs to be cooked at home.
But I wondered about this. I wonder why that was such a steadfast rule in your book.
Because a dinner party is a reflection of you, and it is a gift. And so by cooking the food at your home, you are investing in your guests. And similarly, you're providing something for them. You're not pressing them into service. Hopefully, they'll respond by giving you a dinner party later on. The other reason a potluck doesn't work is I don't know where you live, but I only have one table in my house to feed people. And if I put all the food on it, then they can't sit around the table, which forces people to stand up and have a plate in one hand and like a beer in the other, which makes it impossible to bite. And that's a situation you don't want to put
people
in.
And you end up with multiple conversations. Again, you're not gathered around that dinner table because there's no room for place settings, that kind of thing. If you have two tables and one table has all of the, you know, your 51% of food and their 49% of food, and you've got a separate table where you all sit down and eat, we could imagine that happening.
Brunch.
<How's> that?
Brunch is hell. We're talking about that today on The State of Things. Brendan Francis Noonan, Noonim, and Rico Gagliano are my guests, the host of the Dinner Party Download and the authors of this book, Brunch is Hell. What about now? All right, we've done it. All right, I cooked all the food. I've got it in the house. The bathroom is clean. And I've got everybody around the table. I got just the right guest. The art of conversation, whose responsibility is that? Is that mine as the host to get that thing going in the right direction?
Well, hopefully by this point, people have been talking a little bit because we talk about small talk at the beginning of the night when people are coming in, you're taking their coats, maybe they're having a beer or a glass of wine or something. And small talk has a purpose, which is for people to take each other's measure and get to know each other. And hopefully by the time you're seated, there's some conversations rolling already. But yes, we do think the host has to be vigilant, and we suggest some tips for how they can kind of prod the conversation into deeper, more interesting conversation.
Yeah, specifically stories. We actually have – it's interesting. We have a quote in the book that we got from Alan Alda when we interviewed him. He actually has done research, scientific research about the way information is transmitted between people. And stories are one of the greatest ways you can do that because literally they've done MRI scans. You can see that the brains of two people sync up when one person is telling a story to the other. You're literally almost mind melding. So you want to try to provoke those kind of stories. And we have a number of ways of doing that. One of them is by, say, asking people to talk about extremes in their lives. And that can be relative. If you find out that one of your guests has a kid who just got their driver's license, you can ask them, what is the most terrified you ever were to drive with your kid in the car? That's going to bring up an interesting story. Another thing is just to ask what and why a whole lot. Get details with what of the story, and then ask why, which is where the emotional core of a story lies. Why was the story important to you? Why do you care so much about it? Why is it memorable?
The best parties I've been to are parties where people are telling stories like that. Inherently, one of the things you think might be a goal of this is to sit around and talk about issues of the day and try to get our heads around what's going on. But it does seem to me that those conversations, when we start talking politics, when we start talking about issues that don't offer the opportunity for stories, particularly if all of your guests kind of agree, it just gets to be kind of mind-numbing and ordinarily depressing if you're talking about politics. Do we avoid that? Do we just try to stay away from that and just tell personal stories? Or should we allow for that?
I think that's an old rule is don't talk about politics and religion. We think you should, because if not in someone's home after food and wine, where else really? Maybe employment, where you work isn't the right place to do it, nor at the PTA meeting. So we think you should talk about these issues. We suggest some strategies, in fact, because we used to receive this question a lot on our show. How do I talk to someone I disagree with? And I think actually storytelling is one of our strategies, which is instead of just talking about theory and policy, put a face and name on it, instead of just saying, I think this is dumb, actually give an example of maybe a person in your life or someone or a story you read about a human being that was affected by a certain policy.
Or your own life.
Or your own life. And that's going to move people. And then also the other thing we ask people to keep in mind when they're talking about politics is you're not going to change someone's mind over roast chicken and and stuffing. Keep that in mind. Say your case, tell your story, respond. And when it starts to get pinched, just move on to that conversation. But even just showing that you can have a civil discussion, even if you disagree, that goes a long way.
Rico Gagliano and Brendan Francis Nunem are the co-creators of the new book, Brunch is Hell, How to Save the World by Throwing a Dinner Party. Brendan and Rico, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot, man.
They're going to be at Winston-Salem this Saturday, co-hosting a ticketed event with Winston-Salem's public radio station, WFDD, at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art. And you can find out information at our website, stateofthings.org. A program produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.